Hey everyone, thanks for joining me today. Before I start, I just wanted to quickly ask you to check the description below if you wish to help animal sanctuaries and other charities worldwide simply by reviewing vegan products online. It's simple, fast, and at no cost to you. The more you review, the more they donate on your behalf, and you get to decide which sanctuaries or charities you want them to donate to every time you leave a review. Check out the description of this episode for more information. Hi everyone. My name is Seb Alex. I'm the founder of the Middle East Vegan Society, and I give lectures on animal rights and ethics. Thank you for joining another episode of Principles of Change. Today's guest is Monica Miller from the Non-Human Rights Project. Monica Miller is an attorney and works for the organization called Non-Human Rights Project, which focuses on the legal side of animal rights. This was recorded a few months ago. I was quite busy, but I'm so happy to be able to finally share it with you. We're going to be talking about a specific case of an elephant who is kept in a zoo that they brought up and they were able to take to court and see how the current legal system works when it comes to the rights of non-human animals. Monica's work and the work of Non-Human Rights Project is so important, and I find it so amazing that there are dedicated individuals who are spending their time doing this, and I hope that you will learn as much as I learned today and eventually maybe get inspired to get active in this way as well. Thank you again for joining. I'll see you on the other side. Monica, thank you so much for making time for this podcast. I really appreciate it. I can imagine how busy you are usually doing this.
My pleasure. How have you been? I've been great. I mean, times have been a little bit funny these days, but, we're making progress in the animal rights world. So that makes me happy.
Yeah, I actually read about Happy's case recently. And that's one of the main things that pushed me to have you here, because I've never had anyone doing this kind of activism on the podcast. And the whole idea is to make people realize that there's so many different ways of raising awareness about animal rights. So we're going to get to Happy's case later on. I wanted to ask you, why do you think legal change is something that you chose, or why do you think it's important to use legal change in the fight for animal rights?
It's really one of, maybe not one of the only avenues, because there are a lot of avenues, but when I was actually a young child, I always knew I wanted to help animals in some way. And I watched a show called Animal Cops, where they had a woman in a police officer outfit, applying the law, but to animals. And back then it was just welfare laws, but I knew I wasn't going to be the person that goes door to door or, tying myself to a tree. I went to a college, a liberal arts college, where there was a lot of my classmates were the folks that did like Greenpeace and, or Peace Corps, like and protested and chained themselves. And I loved all that activism, but I just knew I'm like an indoor cat, so to speak, but I actually love the outdoors too. But I really felt like my niche would be in advocacy through, like my voice and my writing. And so I went to law school to practice animal law, but there wasn't any animal law at the time. There was like two law schools in the country that had even like one animal law class. So it was hard to even kind of envision what this would look like. But to me, it's the difference between, if you have a right or not. Activism can only, free some, not to say only, but it has its limitations. You free the bunnies in that one farm, or you free this cow, or you educate this person. But at the end of the day, the law hasn't changed, and the law might catch up with society. We need everything to happen in tandem for the law to catch up with society. But you have to have the laws changed in order to have a right. And currently the animals in our country have no legal rights, no substantive legal rights.
Yeah, I understand. Am I right to assume that when you go to study law in animal law in universities, am I right to assume that it's actually always related to welfare?
So they're, correct.
Even there, yeah, they the are just part. Commodities.
Yeah, and insofar as like at law school, you're studying what's existing in the law. So I went to law school exactly 10 years ago, or I graduated 10 years ago. So 13 years I started. And like I said, Vermont Law School and Lewis and Clark were the two law schools that had any program. But most of the time, those were connected with environmental law. And my background's actually in environmental science and policy. I got my master's degree from Columbia in environmental science and policy. So I'm like, there's a lot of animal like protection, protecting the intrinsic value of something that's non-human. So it makes sense that environmentalism, but there's a lot of times, and I did a lot of my work on the intersectionality and the conflict between environmental rights and environmentalism and animal rights, because they do conflict when we talk about endangered species or some other sort of interventions. Like, do you save the elephant that's drowning in a mud pool, or do you say hands off, we're environmentalists? So anyway, all this is to say that nowadays, I would say that the animal law, what you would take in school, would be different, because our cases actually in the last 10 years, because we filed our first animal rights chimpanzee case in 2013. I've heard from my friends now that are teaching animal law, which is a cool full circle, that our cases are in their textbooks now. So they are going to learn about personhood. They're just, the law isn't there yet, but our group has really created the discussion, or has helped center the discussion on rights versus welfare. And it's not to say welfare is bad. We need welfare laws. I mean, we have to, insofar as humans are going to own and use animals for human ends, then we absolutely need welfare. But like, let's be clear, welfare laws exist to keep animals in the situation that they're in, which is not as, you know, recognizing their intrinsic worth and dignity as an individual animal. That we wouldn't need those kind of, you know, the cage has to be 40 inches wide. Well, you know, there shouldn't be a cage, but if we have the cage, we need the welfare law. So that's kind of where that's at. We're the ones saying, you know, unlock the cage and free the animal through the law.
That's great. And you mentioned the word personhood. Do you mind defining what it is and why is it important?
Yes, absolutely. It's really the crux of what we do, but I think it's also at the same time a little bit of a misnomer for two reasons. One is that when you hear person, we often think human, like, you know, that person over there. But legally speaking, a legal person can be anything that the law says that has a right, that confers what we call legal personhood on that thing. So a ship, for instance, like a boat, has had the U.S. Supreme Court or some state courts have recognized that to be a legal person, like over 100 years ago. Corporations are more commonly, you know, today we're familiar with corporate personhood. But, you know, you could give it to really any entity that has a right. And so the focus has been, or like the way the news kind of spins our cases is, you know, animal rights group is seeking personhood rights. But the truth is, we're really only seeking one right, and that's the right to bodily liberty. We don't really care if Happy is called a person, a place, or thing. Like, I mean, I don't like the name thing, but it's not the label we're after. We're after the substance. And so you can give her the right to vote, and it would do very little, even though it'd be a really significant right. It doesn't make sense for an elephant. What we want is her to have the right to exercise the choices that she's able to make in the wild. You know, where do I want to go? Who do I want to talk to? What do I want to eat? Like, these are highly intelligent, very, you know, complex social species. And you're depriving her of every single ability to make choices when she's, you know, in this environment. So yeah, that's the idea. We want her to have the right to not be in that environment. No other right matters to that. And so that would give her the personhood right for the purpose of the writ of habeas corpus, the right to be free from bodily restraint. But it would not give her any other right. It would not give any other elephant any right. That's kind of the limitations of this court process too, is that it is just the one elephant. It's precedent for other elephants, but it's at the end of the day, we're also only able to do so much too.
Yeah. And let's imagine, and again, we'll get into the details later. In Happy's case, you didn't win, but let's imagine that you had won. Why would that not inherently give the same right to all elephants?
Yeah, in a way it would, and in a way it wouldn't. So the best analogy is to look at is the slave cases, the where Black slaves had been detained by masters, and they were able to use the writ of habeas corpus to free themselves from those confinements. So too were women that were considered chattel property under the English common law. They could use this ancient writ in the 1600s when they had no other right to seek habeas corpus. So that's kind of the gist of what the right gives you, is just sort of the freedom from bodily restraint.
All right. And where does science play its role in this? Because I always think about it as, okay, if you go to court to defend the right of personhood, then you obviously, in my head, you'd have to talk about sentience and to a certain extent, I'm guessing intelligence and you know, the ability to feel and have thoughts.
But then again, boats have personhood, so I feel like that's not very a strong point. But does science play a role? And if yes, how?
Yeah, I mean, the science is crucial in our case. And I guess, like, backing up, I should clarify, because our legal system might be different than others, is we have, like, in the U.S. and in some many countries, I guess, I don't know how many, but there's sort of three sources of law. Maybe there's more, but you've got court-made law. And that's kind of, this kind of answers the last question you asked about the limitations, or why it wouldn't be precedent, or why wouldn't it automatically, I guess you asked why it wouldn't automatically. Yeah. So, like, in the case of a black slave, they could free one slave, but it would take an act of parliament or of the legislature to emancipate all slaves. So it would be one. So the Somerset versus Stewart case was the famous example. And so here is that utilization of the common law, the judge-made law that's flexible, adaptable, and can meet the needs of the existing current situation. And they're actually, the courts are required in our country, the common law, they have a common law duty, because it's their body of law, to upkeep it with the science, the ethics, and, like, conventional notions of, you know, equality and things of today. And so that's where the science comes in. The legislature doesn't have this obligation. They pass laws when they want to, but the courts, because they make their judge-made law, and they're an institution based off of justice, of balancing justice. The legislature is the will of the people. This is about not the will of the people. This is about what is right. What is right morally, ethically, scientifically? Was our old rule that animals have no rights, that they can't have this right to bodily liberty, based off of, you know, antiquated science? Well, yeah, it was. Back 100 years ago, we didn't know that elephants had 45-minute long conversations with one another. We didn't know they could convey their ancient migratory routes through communication, you know, or like that they had these, you know, intense altruistic social bonds. We just didn't have the science. And now we have world-renowned, you know, our case had five of the most world-renowned elephant scientists, all unanimous that elephants are autonomous, that it's basically like detaining a human being to detain an elephant in this kind of environment. It's not the same as putting a dog in a house. It's fundamentally different. It's like putting a human being in there and saying, you know, we're taking good care of her because we test her blood every day, and she's friends with the zookeepers, you know, she's friends with the guards. It's like, that's besides the point. She doesn't want to be there. It's not where she belongs. So yeah, that's kind of the gist of what. Yeah,
I'm gonna have to do some research, because I had no idea they would have 45 minutes long conversations.
I didn't either until I was prepping for this case. I mean, I did, because we put it in our petition, like a lot of this science, but sometimes some of this gets lost on us. And I think for those of us that care deeply about welfare, it's almost like it's enough to me that she's suffering. It doesn't matter in a way that she's intelligent too.
Of course.
And so that's why I almost, and actually knowing that makes it more horrendous, like, and horrific to know what's happening. And so I kind of think I shielded myself from some of these facts, because I was aware they were on the table. I put them in the briefs and stuff. But once I was like prepping to argue the case, I was like, wow, wait. So, you know, we're thinking about animals communicating, and it's not just like they're making these little like yes or no decisions. They're like analyzing things. They're like, oh, the Maasai live here. The Maasai, they don't like one group of people, but they like the other group of people, because they, you know, only scare them off with water rather than shoot at them. So there's like our studies that we presented to the court, and you can find them on our website, really like unearth some really jaw-dropping science. And that's the sad thing about science generally, is that it's like, people like Kim Kardashian, I don't know if you know who she is, but the celebrities make so much attention, and everyone knows what's going on in Taylor Swift's life. And it's like, but elephants can talk for 45 minutes with one another. Like, so it's, yeah, I found that science cool, and I had a fun time trying to explain it to the judges. They might have just thought I was a crazy lunatic, because there's like this, touchdown, or what is it? I don't know sports, but there's like elephants do this like high five after they've rushed off of an enemy. They get together and they're like, yeah, we did that. And they like high five each other. And it's called like a touchdown dance or something. And I'm like, that's so cool. Like, you don't see dogs and cats high fiving each other.
That's true.
Not to put down dogs and cats, but yes, I'm just saying these are phenomenal animals.
Yeah, we definitely don't know enough about other animals. And what are the main arguments for and against personhood that you can share with us?
Yeah. So I guess the proper way to look at it is the right, like for or against the right to bodily liberty. And when we talk about the right to bodily liberty, we ask like, what is relevant to that right? Like when I brought up the right to vote or the right to bear arms, I mean, relevant would be like, are you able to be responsible to have a gun? Are you responsible to vote? You know, so we look at what traits are relevant to the right at issue. And the right at issue here is, are you aware that you're confined? Frankly, the law applies to comatose adults, you know, an adult human being who is not aware of their confinement, who is, you know, in a comatose state has the right to bodily liberty because we cherish the right so much. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you're aware of your confinement, that you are, you know, similarly situated to a human being, based on the science, that's what all of our 5 world-renowned experts are saying, is that she because of her cognitive complexity, because of her you know, empathy and altruism and all these traits, it's just like, it's, she's similarly situated to humans for the right to bodily liberty. She's not similarly situated to humans for the right to drive or other things. So it's like, that's kind of the argument. And the other side of that is that it's actually, it violates like the core notion of equality to say no, because our law also requires that like cases be treated alike. And, yeah, you know, when you have two groups that are similarly situated for one purpose and you say you get all of the rights and all the ice cream on the cake and you get nothing, just because for no reason, you look different, you know, you're this. It's like, that's not allowed. And so for the law to perpetuate an arbitrary discrimination threatens the rule of law itself. It threatens our legal system because it's based off of liberty and equality, really. And so when you're saying that, well, equality only matters to this extent, but we'll accept this massive arbitrary, you know, discrimination. It's not the kind of discrimination that hurts your, you know, emotional well-being, like to know you're a second-class citizen. It's a type of discrimination that the law has always disfavored because we can't have an arbitrary, you know, irrational legal system. And so that's kind of the main argument on the other side of this, is if you don't recognize this, you're perpetuating a wrong and you have a duty to correct that wrong as a court, a common law court.
All right. And when we talk about personhood, for example, because it also has the word person in it, and you share that with someone and you say, well, we should give the right of personhood to other animals. What is it, logically and also legally speaking, that stops the, let's say in this case, an animal to have all the same rights as a human? You know, like, yeah, obviously like a cow or an elephant doesn't need to drive a car or vote, but
right,
doesn't the status automatically give the other rights as well?
That's the great question. And that's why like looking to analogies makes sense. So if we look back to the cases where women who back in the 1600s in England, who were, when they got married, they were considered the chattel of their husband. Their husbands could do all they wanted with them. But they still had this one right to bodily liberty and could seek habeas corpus to free themselves if they could prove that their husband was abusing them. So mm-hmm. they had no rights to own property. They couldn't have a contract. And even after getting the writ of habeas corpus issued and sent to a new home, a new husband, they still had no other rights. They just had the right to bodily liberty. So the point is that it would be different if you were born in the United States as a human and you would get the whole panoply of, you know, our constitutional rights and mm-hmm. everything that flows from, you know, being a civil, you know, it's like civil rights. It's your constitutional, civic things that come with being a member of the human society. But we recognize rights. Yeah. Again, for corporations, for nature, we have regulations. Like it's one of the arguments that our opponents made and that we saw from the amicus briefs on the other side, which are called, they're called friend of the court briefs, which allow groups to come in, philosophers, anyone that ostensibly has an opinion that's an expert opinion on a subject, yeah, the courts will let them bring it in. So we had all these wonderful philosophers, law professors, you know, judges, moral ethics, all of the heart and soul on our side. And it was like the ag industry, trade, corporations, all corporations on the other side. But their argument was something like that it would, you know, open the floodgates to allow to put animals in the court system. You know, everyone's going to be litigating over dogs and cats. We can't open the court system to animals, but the court system's already been open to animals. Like, we had trials hundreds of years ago where we put pigs on trial it was all just bogus stuff. But even just in custody cases, what do you do with the dog? They often analyze custody cases through the lens of the best interest of the dog now, or like the best interest of the pet, which is what we do with children, almost like without even thinking about it, because we all know our pets are like family members. And so courts have been treating them like that, even though that's a huge leap in the law. So so I guess all this is to say that even when the courts say there's a statute that says the court, that dogs have a right to be in the best home when in a divorce proceeding, that would give the dog a limited right. It wouldn't let them have any other right, but they would have the one right to have the best home, and that would be some progress.
Okay. And what would you say is the biggest obstacle when you're fighting for things like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is the it's resistance to change. It's the fear of change. And I think that's where the judges kind of are stuck. And I think that fear of losing political money or something. I mean, because the agricultural, like, if we didn't have to deal with trade industries coming in with their big trade money and saying, you know, there's no connection between freeing Happy and the dairy industry. I mean, even if the court said, I'm going to free all the elephants, like if I was a judge and let's just say I went off the rails and issued an opinion, free all the elephants in California, I wouldn't have jurisdiction to do that. And even if I did, the legislature could pass a law and override what I did, because that's kind of how the system works, is statutes can override this common law. They can't override constitutional law. But so it's like, So this concern is really hot air. I mean, it's like it's not even possible. No, it's never going to happen. So they are empty threats, but yet they seem to hold the weight, because they're really what drives that. And so I think it's greed and power and resistance to change. And I think a little bit of it is, I think the public sentiment has to change. And I think it is changing for good. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where really like things are getting good, because everyday people are now sort of starting to see like, yeah, zoos are kind of wrong. Like, they might still want to eat meat. They're not going to be the people that go completely vegan, but there are people that can see the difference between a caterpillar and an elephant. And currently the law doesn't see any difference between an elephant, a cat, a pig, a horse, I mean, or an ant, or, and I'm not trying to put down an ant or a lobster, but at least scientifically it's shown that elephants are much more like us than we and elephants are more like similar in a lot of ways than we are to dogs. Like, elephants are like in our club, you know? And so it's just like, that's so unfair to treat an elephant like an amoeba.
I really want to meet an elephant now.
I know. I would love to meet Happy.
I just want to stare at them and wonder like the thoughts that they're having. Talking about Happy, what is Happy's story and what happened exactly?
It's really sad. She was stolen from her native Thailand during the time period of the Vietnam War. So she's about 50 years old. She was taken as a baby, which is just, when you think about like what kind of mentality, it's like, let's just take this elephant out of a forest and bring it to the United States. So they put her and her family, I think it was like her sisters or cousins, in some sort of performance, like enclosure, like where she was doing tug of war things, which we now know elephant performances are just forcing a human to do these performances. Yeah. So luckily we're at least at that point, but so she was forced to do that. And then they ended up moving her to the Bronx Zoo. They had her in an enclosure with several other elephants at one point, Grumpy, Maxine, and Patty. Grumpy was her cousin, I think, and Patty and Maxine attacked Grumpy, which is really sad. And then this would never happen in the wild or in her native lands, but because the enclosure was so small, and all of our experts attested to the fact that, like, just like human beings, if you put human beings in too small of a space under these, you know, awful conditions, they're going to get snappy at each other. And so anyway, so the sad thing is that because they're such a social species, it's like extra wrong to detain them alone. And yet Happy and Patty now have a fence between them, and they don't they can't interact. So both of them are isolated alone. But yeah, and the Bronx Zoo knows that this is wrong. And they've said they're not going to replace their elephants when they die off. And it's like, well, they don't have to die off. There are sanctuaries for them right yeah. now. And the Bronx Zoo is saying, no, she's better off with us. But yet they still hold the view that this is no place for elephants because they've phased out the exhibit. So it's like, it's got to be just, you know, some sort of psychological power struggle thing.
Yeah. It's very weird because when they say, well, we won't have more elephants, it's kind of like, then you know, is it exactly. It's not the right thing? Well, then if you know, then act on it now. Just, I mean, they should have some mercy at least for
that's exactly it.
Whatever's left from Happy's life to just live freely. And that case, you lost it. And can you share on what basis you lost, or is it too complicated to get into?
No, it's not really too complicated because we can kind of tether it to what the lower court had ruled. But we had two levels of court before the highest court in New York. And the court, because we've brought other cases before elephants, we had our chimpanzee cases, we ended up losing those cases, even though we made progress by even bringing them. And we ended up getting an HBO documentary about us called Unlocking the Cage. And I think that in turn helped more judges start to think about these ideas. So come round when we brought our first elephant case, we did have some precedent already against us that we had to grapple with. And that precedent was held that habeas corpus doesn't apply to a chimpanzee because a chimpanzee cannot bear responsibilities or legal duties is the ruling. But like, that makes no sense because many human beings don't bear legal duties, but exactly. We give them rights. Rights are not tethered to legal duties in that way. It might impose a duty on someone else, but you can have plenty of rights that are not tethered to duties. And so this ruling that was issued was, fundamentally against just human law. So ultimately, when we refiled it, we actually got a judge who completely sided with us at the lowest court level. And she was like, you have made a very compelling case. I would side with you if I wasn't stuck with this dumb ruling that says this. But because I'm a lowest court judge, I have to rule against you, but I wish I could rule for you. We also got a court of appeals decision from the highest court judge, but he wrote a concurrence in one of our chimpanzee cases that said, you know, I think that they might be onto something, and I think that I side with them. And we think that opinion's why we got our case up when we did, because they only take like 5% of these cases. So for us to get the court to take our case was a victory, period. You know, like that was a win in itself. So ultimately when we lost, the court was affirming that middle court ruling. So we lost on the second court level by saying, no, the duties and responsibilities thing. They also said that because even if habeas corpus could apply to an elephant, because she's being just transferred to a sanctuary versus being free onto the streets of New York, that habeas corpus doesn't apply here. And that also was wrong because children are transferred all the time with habeas corpus. Inmates have been able to seek something less than complete release. So none of the reasons held water. We lost on those same two reasons that don't hold water, but that actually gives us more oomph. Like, there's no good reason for us to lose. And we got two amazing dissents, not just because they dissented, which is a big deal in New York. Dissent means a judge that says, I disagree. And there were seven judges on the Court of Appeals. And two of those judges fundamentally disagreed with the other five and wrote very long opinions saying why we're right. And that was a big deal, like 100 pages of opinion in total. So it's huge. And we can take those two dissents and say two of the highest, you know, two judges on the highest court of New York, plus a third, the Judge Fahy, who wrote that separate thing from our chimpanzee case, three of the highest judges in one of the biggest states in our country agree with us. Like, that's huge. So we never saw this as a loss, and as much as an incremental, but a big incremental win, because getting the case there, getting judges to side with us, getting all the media attention we got, it's been good.
That's really great. So I was wondering, when you are doing these cases, that the first thing that I thought was, did they really have a chance of winning, or do they do it even though they know they're going to lose? Because the final result of losing doesn't necessarily mean that the whole thing was a loss. It's more about putting this on the table.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we went into our first case. I mean, we've always gone into our cases knowing we have the potential to win. We believe greatly in the merit of our cases. This is not like you know, PETA, for instance, files a lot of great things or does a lot of great things, but sometimes they file things intentionally for media, for better or worse. But sometimes those cases are not like thoroughly thought out legally or might even backfire legally. And I, again, not pointing fingers because we've all had bad cases, but just that we've gone in knowing that the law and the facts are fundamentally on our side across the board, but yet the judge's opinions, you know, and societal bias against animals having rights is so strong that the chances of winning are very slim. But we also know that the nature of the common law is that it does build off of society's, you know, like, you know, the moral compass of today and the science of today. And so the momentum that we could build, we didn't have any idea that the amount of publicity that we would get. I mean, I think we always knew that, you know, just like any case, I do First Amendment cases in my other job, I always get some publicity. Maybe I go on Fox News, but the amount of publicity we've gotten, we could never foresee. And that in itself is a humongous source. I mean, for the reason that PETA would file a case just to bring publicity, we're getting the publicity because of what we're filing has so much merit. It's attracting legal scholars. We have Jane Goodall on our board of directors. You know, we've got these world-renowned elephant scientists that are regularly on PBS shows and National Geographic shows. And so the notoriety of what we're doing, I think, is bringing in that some of that. But anyway, so yeah, knowing that we were going to lose was certainly at the beginning, you know, 10 years ago when we filed the chimpanzee cases. And each time we filed, we have more hope, but again, knowing the resistance. So for me personally, when I went in to argue this case, which The Atlantic, one of our big publications in the US, said it was like the most important animal rights case of the 21st century, just the court even taking the case is historic. You know, I had that attitude of like, this is already history. You know, if we win, that would be even more history and insanely awesome. But like, I would love to just be able to change, you know, the minds of a few people in the public that are watching this or hearing this, or, you know, the judges, to get them to think about it better. And so that's why the gift of getting two, not one dissent, but two really compelling dissents, the content of what are in those written opinions from these two judges is so deep. You know, one of the judges is comparing, gets into the nitty gritty about slavery, Black slavery, and how, you know, the reliance on those cases is in no way, shape, or form comparing an elephant to a human being in terms of like characteristics. But our opponents like to spin everything because that's what oppressors kind of do, right? It's like the same mentality. And so he was able to take apart that kind of oppressor mentality and say, just because of this doesn't mean that. But at the same time, when you fix animal rights and when you target, when you go against these oppressors, you're actually paving the way for more human rights. Like, this is, we should all care about happy because we should all care about humans. And like, they go hand in hand. And so what's written in those opinions is all in those dissents is so much more than we expected. So in some ways it's like, I was hoping to just not have them make fun of us, you know, like have it be really harsh on us and like, why are you wasting our time? Like, get out of our state. You filed too many of these. Like, we had no idea what their attitudes would be. So they took us very seriously. I think I got a question from every single member of the court. They ended up letting us go way over the time allotted. We got 10 minutes allotted, and I think I spoke for like 30 minutes because they had that many questions. Like, it wasn't just me talking. It was like, wait, no, but I want to know this. I want to know this. And all the judges were curious, and they weren't like hostile. They were curious. I mean, they had maybe hostile tone. I think some people didn't like the tone of the judges, but that's just how judges talk.
Okay. And how can the general public help? Someone who's not directly involved in this, they see what you're doing. Are there petitions, or how does it work?
Yes. Well, we have our change.org petition. I don't want to say the wrong URL, but it's like free happy on change.org.
Yeah.
But we also have on our website, which again, I'm really bad with links, but I'm sure we can get them to you afterwards.
I'll put them in the description.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So we have a link somewhere on our website for specific form letters to send to the Bronx Zoo, and specifically the board of directors that makes those decisions, like putting pressure on them, because it's actually also the Wildlife Conservation Society that also gets to decide this because they own part of the Bronx Zoo. So it's very confusing, but the bottom line is we've got forms. Also, tweeting about happy and taking to social media is really, really, really helpful, because it's also the same thing as putting the pressure on those that are in charge, but also again, like getting it, you know, if celebrities are very instrumental, Cher helped get Kavan out of Kavan the elephant out of Pakistan. I think Cher did end up tweeting about our case, but it would be lovely to get like some younger, not that not age matters, but just like some young hip celebrities to like tweet about Happy, or just but any people, like any people will get attention, and it's that attention that builds upon you know itself, yeah, and helps the courts see that this is being taken seriously, and like we see these shifts each year we filed a new case where we've been in front of new judges, and it's like it's getting better and better and better as far as like who knows about Happy. Like I'll run into people around my community, and I live in California, which is as far away from New York as possible, where I argued the case, and people know about Happy because of our case, and it's just yeah, so amazing that that's, you know, like that you found us out about us. Like, I mean, it's just, it's really, that's, yeah, that's the power of people. That is the power of media and all the individuals. Like I've, you know, thanked the reporters that have done interviews for us, because it's, that's how progress happens. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not even on the other side of the country. I'm on the other side of the world, and yeah, I heard about it. So it shows
so
that.
Cool.
Okay, and my last question, I ask this to every single person I interview. What are your core principles that help you fight for change?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, just animals having rights kind of has been a core principle of mine. Like when I was in third grade, I became vegetarian because I knew that a chicken was meat. So I think I have, maybe some people have that internal like animal improvement for animals, like maybe it's the innocence of them combined with the helplessness of the situation and the wrongness of the combination of that just inherently drives me. And yeah, I mean, I think any kind of severe injustice, you know, for humans, the environment, something, you know, that just drives me. If I have the ability to fix it, it kind of makes me feel responsible. Or if I have the ability, not even ability to fix it, but to increase the chances of that thing. So, I mean, I guess you could philosophically describe me. I'm a humanist, but I'm also an effective altruist. And yeah.
Amazing. Monica, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I learned a lot, and I'm sure everyone who's listening will learn as well. I hope this will inspire people to take part in this kind of activism as well, because it's definitely extremely powerful. Thank you so much to you and all the team.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
We're really grateful.
I hope you enjoyed listening to the work of Non-Human Rights Project as much as I did. I hope you felt inspired. I think it's absolutely amazing that there are people out there doing this work. If you enjoy this podcast, please feel free to leave a review on whichever platform you're using to listen to it. And if you'd like to support it in any way, please check out my website, zepalex.org. Thank you again for joining us today. I'll see you in the next episode.